Welcome, everyone, to Midday Magazine for this September 1st, 2023. I have your host, James J. Mailoff, here. At 3:30, we're going to welcome in our good friend Connie Tomsky-Fayville from FRM Music, and we're going to talk about FRM Fest coming up. Right now, we've got our friend Scott Krug, Wisconsin State Representative, joining us right now on the phone. Scott, how are you?
I'm good. How are you today, James?
Doing good. Enjoying this weather. Well, it's enjoyable. I mean, we got some heavy stuff coming up here. Just going to enjoy it, though. We know what's coming in a couple of months. Just going to enjoy the warmth while we can and be safe out there, everybody.
Yeah, I mean, 105 on Monday doesn't sound awful one more time, so why not?
Yeah. Scott is going to be joining us, as he usually does, in the opening slot here on Fridays. But next October 6th, the next time Scott is joining us, we're actually going to be playing him at 3:30, in part because you got plans that day. You're going to be at the legislative breakfast.
That's right. Yeah, I'm glad. Well, somebody's got a good eye on my calendar, at least. I end up just looking the day of and just figuring out where I need to go. So, right.
Scott, what is it about those that is so important, you feel, for representatives to be representing at?
Well, you know, honestly, I think it's the biggest part of the job entirely is to not be in the Capitol, but to be back home and just let people know what's going on down there when we are down there. So, I mean, you know, the whole process behind the curtain type thing is, you know, I've got two staff people down in Madison. We have got all the technology in the world. I don't need to be in that building unless we're having a committee hearing or voting on bills. So I like being back here at home to do those events, to make sure people know exactly what's going on, so they get the absolute, you know, final word on what is actually happening instead of hearing things, you know, second and third hand all the time. So.
Mm-hmm. Scott, I wanted to get into rewinding a little bit here, but we didn't get a chance to talk afterwards. The Republican debates were recently here right in Milwaukee. What were your takeaways from that?
Well, I mean, it's good for tourism for Milwaukee.
yes, right away. Agree. Couldn't agree. That's a perfect first statement. That's awesome. And couldn't agree with you more.
Economic development, right?
Mm-hmm.
People all week have been asking me, like, did you go to the debate? Did you watch the debate? I'm like, no, I didn't. I mean, it's not my lane, you know? I mean, when we get to the point where we have a primary here in Wisconsin, the process will work through, the people will pick who they think might be their best choice at that point. But I thought it was just way too early in the season to have this first debate, because even things in Madison really don't get going until Labor Day and after, when people are back to school and done with vacation. So start talking presidential debates in August. I think they jumped the gun and missed an opportunity just to wait until people are settled back into their routine to get to know their voters at that point.
It reminds me, I got a buddy of mine. He just will not watch a basketball game until like the fourth period. He doesn't see any point. He's like, the games always go back and forth. You never know. It's always decided in the last couple minutes. So he literally won't watch a game until like the last quarter.
Well, I mean, that's basketball for me too, right? I mean, unless it's high school, tournament on TV or March Madness. I mean, even NBA, I don't really watch till playoffs, and deep into the playoffs, maybe it gets interesting. But I mean, it's the same with presidential politics, is that 3/4 or maybe 4/5 of those people up on that stage are not going to be on the ballot, you know, when it comes time to pick and choose who we want in our primary. So I'm glad they each got their, 10 seconds to yell at each other, but I will check in the fourth quarter.
Well, and you're not alone on that, Scott. That actually is the perfect answer to set me up where I wanted to go with this, because I've talked to a number of our community members here in town. I've done some reading on NPR and WPR and some other sites too about this most recent batch of Republican nominees. And the big takeaway from this that I took was in part some interesting stuff there. So when it comes to former President Donald Trump not being at the debates, the feedback from even Trump supporters was they were thankful he wasn't there, because the big thing that I am hearing from a lot of them is, one, that he has become, even supporters of him, that he has become a distraction, and that he's not the candidate that they voted for that first two times that they did. But also that they are not able to learn about other candidates because he takes up the news cycle. There's only so much news, and all of it is being centered around him and these other candidates. People don't have the time or aren't able, don't have the bandwidth to be able to learn about or take in. Do you think that this is going to continue, that this could be a continued distraction for the Republican Party going forward with this?
It will be. I mean, that's just how this whole process is going to work on both sides. You know, I mean, even on the Democrat side, when people start talking about, is Joe Biden too old? Are we going to see somebody else come in? And you're going to hear all these chatters on both sides. And, you know, that's just politics as usual, people trying to distract from who the main candidates are. And, you know, we'll get to the point where we start vetting out some of these people. You know, in retrospect and things I hear after the debate, Nikki Haley did great. You know, Ron DeSantis had a good message. Mike Pence didn't do as good as people thought he would. And, you know, so you kind of can read through the tea leaves on who's going to be there and who's not going to be there, who's going to be the main challengers. So we'll keep our eyes on who's going to New Hampshire and who's going to Iowa. And, you know, there's the kind of that process we've been through a few times, especially in my career, is just knowing when to pay attention, who to pay attention to. I mean, like I said, there's going to be a bunch of those guys, Chris Christie and Vivek and some of these other guys who are just wanting to be noisemakers instead of actual real candidates. So it's going to take some time to sort out. So I think people got plenty of time to do more research on their own and, you know, look at those individual candidates outside of that forum and just figure out who to keep on their radar before they start making choices later in next year.
You mentioned Ron DeSantis, and one of the individuals I talked to who is a Trump supporter, she was telling me that she was disappointed in DeSantis wasn't more bombastic, that he wasn't more loud. And those were her words. I made sure to write them down. This P.T. Barnum approach to politics that seems like a lot of people are leaning into, specifically on the Republican side, but the Democratic side as well. It's not that as if this has an R.D. in front of its name. Do you think we're going to get away from that or lean more into it?
I want to get away from it. That's exactly what I want to get away from. I mean, you know, take, for example, the work we're doing in the Assembly Campaigns and Elections Committee versus what's going on the Senate side in campaigns and elections, where they're still beating those drum beats and, you know, trying to capture all of that anger. And, you know, we're looking at policy. We're looking at making real significant change, passing bills through our committee that can get signed into law so we can fix problems that actually exist. I mean, this bombastic populism approach to politics is getting nobody anywhere. I mean, you're just making noise and ginning people up, and then you can't get to legislative solutions and pass bills and create budgets and do all the things that we're actually really supposed to be doing. So I'm glad that DeSantis is more of an in-between where Donald Trump is on the loud side and where Mike Pence is trying to be the actual counterweight to it. DeSantis and Nikki Haley and Tim Scott, some of those guys and gals in the middle to the middle right. I mean, those appeal to me a lot more than someone who's going to yell and interrupt. And I mean, you look at debates in the last 4 to 6 years on the presidential side, you can't even watch them when it gets to head to head because nobody actually either answers the questions or lets somebody else answer their questions without interrupting constantly. It's childish behavior. So
recently, this kind of broke over the night. Wisconsin Republicans circulated proposals on child care affordability. For those that have not been able to read into what that is, can we get into that, Scott?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is one of the bigger things that emerged during the budget process was, you know, during the height of COVID, the federal government sent all kinds of money down to the states. And one of the things that the governor created was a $400 million some program around child care that, you know, once federal money ran out, he didn't have a source of money to keep funding that program. So now we're looking at ways to try to figure out, you know, what actually was impactful from that instead of just putting money into things. How do we actually create slots? How do we actually have daycares improve their facilities so they can qualify for better ratings, so people trust them more? So this whole package that we just put out yesterday that I signed on to from Representative Golden, Representative Hurd, and Senator Quinn, the child care package we're talking about really revolves around, yes, we're going to put money into this process, but we're also going to figure out ways to help infrastructure of these facilities so they can actually make repairs and build things that are safe and make sure parents can trust that they're getting the highest ratings. And so it's quite an intricate package of bills that is going to help keep our ratios set for the number of kids that can be in a home. One of the bills is currently saying, well, you know, in home daycare, we allow 6 children to be in anybody's home to provide daycare, but three of them have to be your own children. Up to three of them can be your own children. So one of the bills actually says, well, if you're going to be a home daycare and you don't have kids, so you don't have to be limited to three, we can actually take care of the same six kids as your neighbor does, just because three of them are her own. So it's just getting rid of some of those bureaucratic things that just don't make sense to allow more slots to be open to give people more options and choices in childcare.
There is some fear that the loosened regulations could turn hurt quality. Are there things in place in this bill to kind of counter that or keep an eye on that?
Well, that's what YoungStar exists for already. And that's one of the things when I chair Children and Families for two sessions, that we keep making sure that we're keeping Department of Children and Families on top of, you know, quality ratings for every daycare in the state of Wisconsin, giving them star ratings so they're easily to be interpreted by parents as quality daycare centers or not so high quality daycare centers. So YoungStar, in its existence for the past decade and a half, has done a really great job on sorting out where you should go and where you should maybe look twice at going. And Department of Children and Families is doing a great job with that. And they're always funded appropriately in the state budget to maintain that program, so you know where quality is and where it needs to be improved.
This is certainly good for headlines and, more importantly, hopefully good for Wisconsin families, but it doesn't feel like enough. Is there talk with you and your colleagues of doing more for childcare in the state?
I don't know how much more can be done, right? I mean, people talk about trying to continue the program that existed from federal dollars. And if the federal government had more money to put into what we're doing for childcare on top of the state money that we're already putting in through the state budget, and now with these bills, there isn't much more we can do to create more slots, because creating that workforce is something that is the bigger challenge right now than opening slots. If we don't have a workforce that's even available to provide slots, that's our biggest challenge. So we've got to make sure that we can possibly do a little bit more on the education side with the technical college system for licensing and some things like that. But we're opening as many slots in as many centers as we possibly can, without just throwing direct money at people just to say, okay, here's what you're supposed to do, and, you know, we have to trust that you're going to do what you want to do with that money. So I think the package that we have in front of us, the $90 million that we invest in the state budget, I think that's about as good as we're going to get this session on child care issues in the state of Wisconsin.
Speaking with State Representative Scott Krug, and Scott, piggybacking off of that, you mentioned other things we can do. Wisconsin's minimum wage is $7.25. It has been that since 2008. Do you think there's any change of that coming in the future?
No, I don't see that at all, because you can't. I would challenge anybody who's listening today or any other day to find me a business anywhere in Wisconsin Rapids that's still paying $7.25 an hour. So when we talk about government setting minimum wages, the market has eclipsed that enormously. If you go look at starting wages at Quick Trip or McDonald's or CVS or anywhere up and down A Street, you're not going to find a $7.25 an hour job right now. You're looking at $12 an hour starting jobs to $15 an hour starting wages. Even third shifts at Quick Trip are paying almost $20 an hour at this point. So I think an artificially set minimum wage by the government is already ignored entirely by the market.
But, and I'll even give you that, but this is the reason why we have laws and bills to hold accountability. That may be the case, but we don't know for a fact that everybody is doing that. In order to make sure that they do that, having a government minimum wage, a state minimum wage, is very important.
I don't know so much. I mean, so here's where employees and employers have these conversations, and where an employee could see in the marketplace where we have less than 3% unemployment that their value is not to stay at a job that pays them $7.25 an hour when the place across the street is going to allow them to make $12 or $15 an hour. I can't imagine any individual who's going to want to stay at a business to work at $7.25 an hour when there are opportunities almost up and down A Street in Wisconsin Rapids, as an example, or up and down Watoma's main drag or wherever else it may be that's going to pay them a much higher wage than where they might be trying to be pigeonholed in for $7.25 an hour. And I think that's one of the points that I've always tried to make to people, is you can't rely on government for everything, right? You've got to be able to be a consumer that makes good choices, whether it's in your information that you're getting from the television or the radio, or whether it's making choices for your employment situation, that you're not going to take the crappiest job just because it's the first one out there. So I think there's a lot of individual responsibility to make sure that you can maximize your opportunities and find the best path for yourself. And I think, like I said, the minimum wage has been eclipsed nationwide, and I can't imagine anybody could call in even right now and tell me, yes, I know my cousin's working over at the Shell station on A Street making $7.25 an hour. It's not happening right now.
And I don't disagree with that, but I do think the businesses, the accountability needs to be that having a bill in motion for this. Not only does that, but Senator Tessin and I were just talking the last couple of times we've talked about bringing in people from out of state. I'm not going to know that if I'm looking at Wisconsin, I'm just Googling and looking at Wisconsin's, national minimum wage. I'm not going to know that in the town I'm moving into that they're paying businesses on that main street more than that. It doesn't help that part of things either any more than it does help keeping businesses accountable for this.
So the accountability is that they're not going to be able to draw people to come work there if they're paying $7.25 an hour, James. They're just not going to. Nobody's going to go apply there if they're paying that type of wage anymore. So I get what you're saying, but I think that's probably the last thing people think of when they're looking for a job is what does the government set as the minimum wage?
Okay. Let's talk water quality. Let's go sure. on. There's been some progress on water quality. I want to get into that with you a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, I'm excited. Tomorrow's our annual meeting for the Tri-Lakes Lake District that I serve on down here in Rome, Arrowhead, Camelot, and Sherwood. And I live about a mile from the beach here, so on my daily walk down, I get down to the beach, and for the first time that I can remember in the last 10 years living in Rome, I'm walking through a clean lake here on Arrowhead. And when you go down to the other side, just down the hill from me, you go down to Lake Peatonwell, you get onto the lure, and you go have a dinner down there, you're not smelling stinky blue-green algae anymore like you were 10 years ago either. Mm-hmm. So I am thrilled to see how far we've come on making sure that there's cooperation between agriculture and the residents of the area to make sure that we can still produce all the things we need to do to feed the rest of the world, and we can keep the water clean at the same time. So it has been yeoman's work over the last decade to start seeing some of these things come to fruition. And it's going to be exciting tomorrow to be able to present some of these results and some of the new technologies we're using here at our little lake district to show how we can replicate further success in the rest of the lakes of Wisconsin on keeping water clean.
You and Senator Tessin, Katrina Shankland, you three I've been talking to for a long enough time now that I remember when this was some of our early conversations, and it felt like we were just trying to get people to pay attention to the subject. How good does it feel to be at this point right now?
I mean, it's career defining. I mean, I could walk out the door at this point just because, like I said, 10 years ago to have even a conversation about this was the most uncomfortable thing that you could think of in politics. It was like, it was a third rail. Like, okay, how do we get egg producers to understand the impacts that are being felt by people here all over central Wisconsin because of some of the practices that are ongoing? And then, like we had the talk about minimum wage where the threat of legislation actually held employers accountable, this one did. So like I said, I took your point on it. We did put out ideas for legislation that started to drive producers towards changing how they operate before it got to the point where we mandated that they had to. And things changed really quickly, and you started seeing a lot more producer-led watershed groups take shape here all around central Wisconsin because of a bill that I wrote in 2013 with Amy Loudenbeck to cost share a lot of those activities that they would need to take care of so they didn't feel like they were all alone. And it's been a great, great success story for Central Wisconsin to have a bipartisan approach to water quality that can bring industry and tourism and agriculture and everybody all together to fight for the same thing.
Yeah, it really is a great example, too. There's almost a blueprint that's been written here of when you want to get things like this done, of how to make them happen. You mentioned bipartisanism and some of that and everything. It's so much of what's happening in Wisconsin right now politically, and I understand there are outliers. They are in every state, but in Wisconsin in particular, I feel like is such a great example to the union of what's happening here. So much purple is happening here, and I think so much less divisiveness than there is in other states, and I think that that's something we can hold up to the whole union and show and as an example.
Yeah, and I think that's the exact lane that I've chosen to show exactly how we can do this across the board. So that is how we operate in the Assembly Campaigns and Elections Committee. And I've told anybody that's going to write an elections bill, don't even think about bringing it to our committee unless you have bipartisan co-sponsorship in both the Assembly and the Senate. And now every author that's bringing election bills forward is making sure they're reaching out bicameral, bipartisan bill authors to come forward and say, okay, all four of us in both chambers, the Assembly Democrats, the Assembly Republicans, the Senate Democrats, Senate Republicans, there's one of each of us standing in front of you, Mr. Chairman, on this bill, and we all think this is a great idea. So it's just been a great example to set, and I really hope that the Senate counterpart to that committee starts taking that same approach soon, and we can actually get these bills through both chambers and signed into law by the governor to actually fix some of the real things that do exist in our election process that do need to be changed. You know, whether it comes to collecting nomination papers or registering candidate committees, I mean, there's still things that have to be fixed. And that's what we're trying to tackle on that committee by using that same approach we use on water quality, making sure we're all on the same page, making sure the things that we talk about in committee are already agreed to, making sure that we can make them better through the process and get them actually signed into law.
Appreciate the behind the curtain look there, Scott. Thank you for that. As we're wrapping up here, just a couple more things. Scott, would you ever climb a cell tower?
Boy, if you don't know the story about me and height yet, I'll have to tell you on a story on a show at some point. So I've never actually been above the fourth floor at the state capitol, you know, where you can go all the way up to the top, take the stairs way up there. There's no way I'm going up to a cell tower. I've still not gone to the top of the capitol. So.
Next time, I want to hear that story. Next time, when we got more time, I want to hear that. I bring it up because a while back, Federal Communications Commission Commissioner Brendan Carr made a bet with U.S. Rep. Mike Gallagher that the representative wasn't brave enough to climb a cell tower. They did all this, of course, to bring attention to broadband and the $1.1 billion of broadband expansion as part of the federal infrastructure investment. This is a big investment, though, in all seriousness. This is really huge for the state of Wisconsin, especially our rural areas.
It is. And one of the struggles I've got with the continued funding of broadband access, I think technology is passing us by quicker than we can actually spend the money. I mean, we've thrown gobs and gobs of money towards expanding, fiber optics and all of these technologies that were great in the 90s and the 2000s. But I don't know that they're actually going to be the technologies moving forward into the 2020s and 2030s. So, for example, I've got Starlink service when we travel with the RV, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Starlink and some of those other companies like them are starting to talk about community-based satellite internet service. And I'm like, well, if we can't find enough providers, that's our problem right now, is not finding enough providers that want to take the money to expand that next quarter mile into rural areas because it's so cost expensive to lay that last mile of line all the way out into the middle of nowhere where you don't even need to lay line anymore into the 2020s and 2030s. So we've really got to start looking at technologies that are expanding right now and targeting our investments towards the things that make the most sense.
Did you get a chance to take in any of our great fairs?
Honestly, I didn't. Amanda and I came down with whatever the heck has been going around the last 2 weeks here. Adams and Washera were on the same weekend as Wood County, so I was kind of hoping that'd be a busy weekend, but I did not get to any of the fairs this year because we came down with this whatever sickness that everybody's been getting, almost, it felt like COVID-like, but didn't quite register there. But yeah, it took us down for a darn near a week, so it's the first time ever that I didn't get a chance to get to the fairs and bid on kids' turkeys and chickens and cows and pigs. And
next year, you guys feeling better?
Yeah, I think we're finally at the back end of it here. So we're actually out in Bancroft camping this week to get more fresh air.
Right on. Very cool. Because we're friends, I didn't bring up the Brewers. It's been good.
You should bring up the White Sox, right?
Oh, dear God.
Reinsdorf threatening to move the White Sox actually helps the Brewers not think about relocating because I think Reinsdorf's going to beat them to Nashville.
Yeah, he will.
Before they can think about relocating.
So. Jerry Reinsdorf is one of the worst owners of all time.
Absolutely. Yeah. Dan Snyder, that's right.
I'm so glad we're running out of show. I don't have to talk anymore White Sox. always appreciate you, Scott. Thank you so much. You guys have a great, safe Labor Day weekend. We'll talk again real soon, sir.
Absolutely. Take care.
Thanks. More Midday Magazine coming up right here on WFHR.